show you a better way.
Hi, folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Friday the 18th, 2013, and this is episode 1057 of the Survival Podcast. I know what you're thinking, it's Friday, and that means we'll be doing calls. We're not going to be doing calls, because we're in the middle of this move, and frankly, it's lucky that I'm even able to get a couple shows out this week. Next week may even be less shows out, and then we'll be back to the regular scheduled format after that with our move back to the great Lone Star State of Texas. Yesterday I did a show, Zero to Prepared, Fast, Simple, and Low Cost. The original intention for that was for that show to be quick, 1 hour show, and everything done and finished in one episode. And then I was at an hour and only halfway through the material. And I thought, great, that solves my problem this week. I'll just do part two tomorrow. So that's what we're going to do today. Part two of Zero to Prepared, Fast, Simple, and Low Cost. Today we're going to cover the other three survival needs: energy, security, and sanitation and health. Yesterday we covered food, water, and shelter. By the time we're done today, we'll have covered all of the basic survival needs, how to get into an initial state of basic preparedness, a state that, frankly, every American should be in already. The stuff that we're talking about here is not advanced preparedness. This is basically the way that if we gave a damn about civil defense and individual responsibility, individual liberty, and self-determination in this country, there would be the way that most people lived day-to-day, every single day, and a lot of the catastrophes would be averted if we did this, and the ones that can't be just stopped cold would be severely mitigated if everybody lived this way. In other words, what I'm saying, this is just an intelligent way to live. Before we get into that, though, let's go ahead, take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day number one, KnifeKits.com. What I love about Knife Kits is anybody, even me, can build a great knife at KnifeKits.com. Even if you don't know how to use something like a grinder and forge your own blades with heat and do all that stuff, you just want to get stuff that's basically ready to go and you fit it together. You select your own handle material, you shape it, you sand it down, you select your own bolsters, you do your final sharpening, you can get that. Now, if you are the guy that can run a forge and you can do everything from scratch, you want exotic raw materials, you can get the coolest stuff in the world there too. I mean, I have a knife that a knife maker that listens to the show made for me that's got mammoth tusk handle on it. How cool is that? But if you just want to get started, like, it's about the same level of skill required to build one of those models you got when you were a kid that you had to, you know, you stepped up to glue together models where you had to paint them. About that level of skill. If you still need help, get a book and a DVD while you're there. It'll show you how to do everything you need to know to put the kits together. So the beginner and the pro alike can build great knife at KnifeKits.com. Check them out today. Next up today, Sawtooth Tactical. Nestled in the Sawtooth Wilderness of Idaho, Sawtooth Tactical gives you all the things you need to live that tactical lifestyle. Veteran-owned and veteran-operated, so you know you're going to get great service every single time and great pricing to go with it. And if you tell them that you found them on TSP, they usually throw something extra in the box, a hank of paracord or who knows what, but I found that a lot of times people tell me, hey, they sent me this or that, and it's just something cool, a little extra once in a while to thank you for your business and for being part of the TSP community, because they're a great supporter of the show. Both Knife Kits and Sawtooth Tactical do offer discounts to the Member Support Brigade, so that's a great segue into the MSB. If you want to help support this show at 18.3 cents an episode, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. You do that, you help support us. You get great discounts to companies like Knife Kits and Sawtooth Tactical and over 30 other companies. I got some new stuff coming for you this week with that as well. And, you know, if you're military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, or first responder, like, say, a paramedic, I do offer a service discount for the Member Support Brigade. Just email me before you join with a subject saying service discount. Tell me who you are and what you're doing, or who you are and what you did if you're prior service, and I'll respond back with your code. To find more about the Member Support Brigade, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on the Member Support Brigade banner, or just click on members at the top of the page. Last but not least, guys, I want to remind you one more time about 13skills.com. Get on over there. Dorothy, on the 13 Skills blog today, posted her recipe for making your own laundry detergent. A lot of you have asked about that, so that's over there now on the blog. We are at 4,689 members. I would love to end this month at 5,000 members. You can help me with that. Tell your friends, your family, anybody that's interested in improving their skills, whether they're into preparedness or not, about 13skills.com, and tell them to get over there and take the challenge. It's a really cool site, and it's getting cooler every day as David continues to expand its capabilities. Soon you will have the ability to better communicate with other members and share information and ideas beyond using the dedicated board in our forum. You will have the ability to maybe directly communicate with those you're following and those that are following you, and to help be a mentor in the skills that you already have. We're working on that, but it's one guy doing all the programming, guys, just so you know. All right, with that, we've got the housekeeping segment wrapped up today, and I want to continue on from where we were at yesterday. This is really a show that if you haven't heard part one, you really need to go listen to part one first, because I don't want to redo the entire intro to that show where I talk about the basics of the six survival needs and the tenets that go along with them and the basic logistics. I'm going to go straight into the next subject. So if you have not heard part one, it's episode 1056, and you can listen to that one before this one, and the rest of this will all gel together for you. All right, so when we look at energy, I talked about this a bit in the first part, but we need to look at energy when we look at it in our daily preparedness is the counterpart to fire in wilderness survival. If you are out in the wilderness and you're alone, either by choice or by accident, and you need to provide for yourself while you're there, one of the things that really makes your life a lot easier is the ability to start a fire. This is why when people say, well, I want to learn to do a bow drill, I want to do a hand drill, I'm like, yeah, and carry a Bic, and carry a Zippo, and carry a ferrocerium rod, and carry a flint and steel, and carry anything and everything you can that will make fire for you, and learn how to make fire beyond the primitive, learn how to make fire from sticks and twigs and branches, learn how to actually make a fire with a match. A lot of people that are trying to learn how to build a fire with a bow drill, if you gave them a single match, they might have a hard time getting a fire anyway. And if you can't do it with a match, you're really going to have a hard time doing it with a tiny coal out of your baseboard from your hand drill, right? But it's very important that you're able to build fire in the wilderness because it does so much for you. With fire, I can stay warm. I can provide myself some security. I can cook. I can purify water. I can use it to make tools. I can use it to harden points. I mean, it's so valuable. And the reason it's so valuable is when you're out in the middle of the wilderness and you look for the light switch on the wall, there's no wall and there's no switch and there's no power and there's no electricity. So the fire is providing you everything on a secondary level that you get from the electrical lines running to your house or to the propane lines or gas lines to your home. It's the energy equivalent in the wilderness. Now, when we move into our houses, we now don't have to use raw heat, right? We can turn the electric oven on and these elements get hot because electricity is flowing to it. Our wet clothes can go into a dryer. We push a button, they spin around and get dry. Okay, when we want to turn a light on in our living room, we flip a switch and on it comes. We turn on the TV. But in the end, it's just energy. It's just heat. So it's the equivalent, and it's really important to think about it that way because all of a sudden it starts to become something you realize that you really do want in your life. A lot of people overlook the energy equation, especially when they get into prepping and they're thinking about the long-term apocalyptic things that are the least likely to happen. I can tell you that of all the preps that we've made in our lives, the ones that we get the most utility out of, the most juice out of, and have made our lives better when there's a problem, have been the energy ones. The fact that we have backup lighting that just comes on so you can see where you're going to get to your stuff. The fact that we have a generator and other things like that, a backup battery charger and what have you. These are the things that when we just were without power for a few days during a blizzard this Christmas, they made our lives basically the same as they always were. You throw in a fireplace, a good supply of wood, and some backup propane space heaters, and our lives went on. We had the Christmas tree lit. We ate turkey and stuffing. We heated it up in our microwave. Right? I know that doesn't sound like rugged individualistic survivalism, but part of what I didn't include yesterday is that we need to be preparing for disasters based on, first and foremost, the order of probability. And the order of probability has a direct inverse relationship with impact scale. So a low probability event would be an asteroid hitting the Earth, ending all life as we know it, or let's say not being big enough to do that, but causing global climate shift, killing half the population, putting us on the verge of but not over extinction, where humans can still adapt to the situation. Very, very high impact. 7 billion people in the world, 3 billion dead, that type of thing. But the probability is very low, and the probability that you as an individual will see it is so low that you have no business even worrying about it until you get to this basic 90-day preparedness plan that we're talking about in these two episodes. There's just no room for it, right? An electromagnetic pulse attacked by a terrorist group. It's in the same category. It's actually more likely. It's more probable, okay? But it's so improbable that it goes in the later category. Now, what's probable? The lights go off at your house for a week. I don't care why. You couldn't pay the bill because you lost your job. Right? Or there's a storm, or there's some type of problem with the grid, a cascade failure based on routine maintenance gone awry. It doesn't matter why. But that's actually pretty probable that you'll see that happen in your lifetime. Things that are more probable would be the lights go off for 2 days, or one, or a day and a half. 2 days without power, no big deal. What if it's 107 degrees in the middle of a heat wave in the summer and you have a baby in the house? Wouldn't it be nice to have at least one room you could run an air conditioner in so that that baby's life is not put in jeopardy? Or an elderly parent. Or you think, well, I don't have an elderly parent living in my house, but their power's off and they live down the road from you or down the other side of the street and the whole city's down and they come stay with you so you can look after them. They show up with maybe something that helps them breathe, like a machine, some type of a medical device. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to run that, keep them cool so that your elderly parent doesn't die of heat prostration while you're dealing with this situation, even for a couple days? See, these are all things that are actually quite probable. Or you're not even thinking that way, but then you don't even know your neighbors very well, but then it turns out when this thing goes off and it goes down that you find out there is an elderly person that lives on your street that you never even really talked to before, and they have no one to look after them, and you want to help them out. Right? You got to think beyond just what you know, because disasters reveal what you don't know. So all of these are reasons to look at energy. But the first thing to do, and the easiest thing that you can do, is set up a basic blackout kit. I'm talking very basic. I'm talking flashlights, extra batteries, candles, stuff like that. Two-way radio with extra batteries for it. If you want to do the crank-up thing, there's some really decent ones out there. Basically, the Eaton FR series of emergency radios are probably the best ones out there. They make some that are branded for the American Red Cross. They make some that are just branded Eaton. They're basically the same radio. One's red, one's brown. That's the only difference between them. You look at the features. Most of the time, what you're choosing between is either you get a radio with AM and FM and shortwave, or you get a radio with AM, FM, and weather band. I will tell you that the people that think about the end of the world as we know it always say you need shortwave. And if you're worried about that, get a ham license to learn to use equipment that's more sophisticated anyway. What you'll get utility out of day-to-day is the emergency weather alert component, and that's the one I would recommend. If you want both features, buy two radios. Two is one is none. Okay, that's another saying we have in preparedness. Two is one, and one is none. That means if I have two, and one breaks, I still have one. If I have one, and something goes wrong with it, I have none. And we've kind of expanded that to two is one is none, and three is a guarantee. So if you want to build your redundancies in sets of threes, you really have built up redundancy there. Don't want to get sidetracked on though. But I mean, those are your basic stuff in your blackout kit. I really recommend another thing that you get for your blackout kit, and you can keep one central blackout kit and some components in your vehicles as well. And what I really recommend is any kind of headband light, a light that goes around your head with a band. When lights are out and you're trying to do things like hook up a generator or find something or write a note or whatever it is, being able to let your hands off of something is a big deal. And it's much better than having somebody hold a light for you and constantly going, no, this way, no, that way. You look, you see. Another really great product for this that's cheap, Home Depot sells them, Lowe's sell them, a lot of sporting goods stores sell them because they're good for fishermen at night. Caps with the LED lights built into the bill, they're okay. They also make little clip-ons that go onto the bill of a hat that use basically like watch batteries in them, LED lights. They call them cat lights or cat eyes, I think. Those are great. Anything like that that can give you hands-free light, that should be part of your backup kit. Lots of stuff in like a box or a bag that's in the house in a known location. Everybody knows where it is. And then maybe some additional things like a headlight, an additional flashlight, some additional batteries, glove boxes or your bug out bag that you keep in your car or some kit you keep in your vehicles, because you might be away from home when there's a problem. And having light on a dark road, very, very important. We can go into whole outlays of things for your vehicle kits. And even if you have a massive vehicle kit, I still recommend a small kit to deal with the fact that it may be dark in a glove box or a map pocket or something like that where it's easily accessed so you can get to your other stuff, all right? But that's basic. Just set up a blackout kit, and you probably have almost everything you need to do this already in your home. You just need to take it from a bunch of different drawers and put it in one place. That said, here's something else I've done. When I go to stores and I see 4 or 5 cheap aluminum LED flashlights with batteries for $8 at Tractor Supply or something like that. You know what I'm talking about. Those little blister packs like that, little, I buy them here and there. We get them home. I take them. I put them. I make sure the light, the batteries in them work. I throw a little light in every freaking drawer. If the lights go off and I need a flashlight, I can open a drawer. If I've taken that one out and not put it back, the next drawer will have one. We have some magnetic ones that we also got from Tractor Supply that have LEDs on them with a magnet they stick to the refrigerator. There's a couple of them there. You can turn those on. You got light in the kitchen until you can figure out what's going on. Little things like this make a big difference. We have a product called Mr. Beams. There's a device that plugs into the wall, and it runs off electricity. It also has batteries. The batteries do not recharge from the wall. They're regular batteries. This is important. Everything I've ever found you plug into the wall that recharges from the wall with a light on it always ends up burning out the batteries. There's not enough intelligence in there to tell it, stop charging, right? So what happens is you plug this little remote control in the wall. If the power goes out, the batteries in it kick in. It turns a light on like a flashlight, and it turns on remote lights throughout your house. In each bedroom, we have a little light that runs off this system down by the bottom of the door, so you can see your way to the door to get out. And in 2 different parts of the house, they almost look like smoke detectors, overhead lights that run on D batteries. That just basically gives you enough illumination in the house to be able to find your way to what you're doing. It's a cool product. It's not what I would consider a long-term solution, but it gives you that initial lighting, especially kids that are scared and whatever. You put, you know, one of these in their bedroom. If the lights go off, they're not stuck in the dark. If they're down in the cellar, things like that, it keeps kids from being scared. It's really a great product, highly recommended, but I would say it's a step beyond your basic blackout kit. The next thing you need to start thinking of, the power's out. Most of us do not cook with gas in the United States. Most of us cook with electricity. If you have natural gas to your home, it is the most resilient system that you will have from an on-grid system. It's more resilient than water and sewer. It is not likely to go out. It can happen. It doesn't happen very often. Consider yourself lucky. Still pay attention to what I'm saying because it could go out and you might need a secondary means. But boy, you've got an asset. And when you're looking at a home to buy a house, if it has natural gas service, give it a gold star as an additional redundancy. If you can, or it already has propane, large propane tank, where you can have the propane delivered every 6 months and have your own gas supply, that also gets a gold star. If you can do both, it's a giant gold star. But definitely, you need to have a way to cook food. Now, there's a bunch of different theories on how you do this best. One of the things that I think most Americans would like to have in their lives is a grill. If you buy a gas grill that has a side burner, you have a gas burner. If you go out and pick up 2 or 3 of the 5-gallon tanks that goes with your typical American gas grill, you have a lot of redundancy. When one's empty, fill it. You'll have months of on supply of being able to do basic cooking on the grill or in a pan just from that. It's so easy, it's so simple, and, you know, almost no matter where you live, there's a place that can refill them or does cylinder exchange, and you can just build it into your daily life. Whenever one's empty, fill it up. If you do that, you've got a source of cooking. Some other things you can look at are small wood stoves, charcoal grills, and things like that. That's fine. Make sure you store fuel for them. The small camp stoves, okay? We have a little single burner camp stove. You put one of those 1-pound propane cylinders into. It works just great. You just only get so much cooking off of 1 pound of propane. But the nice thing is it's portable. It's not as bulky. And those stoves often can have adapters that let them go to your 5-gallon tanks. That gives you more utility, the ability to cook more food. You might be in an outage cooking for neighbors, right? Especially, again, people that come to preparedness, they're often scared to it. So that something's happened that's pointed out the weakness in the world and they're thinking about being this lone guy that's going to go it alone and not tell anybody what you're doing. There's a place to keep your mouth shut. We'll talk about that today as well. But the power's out. Help your neighbor, especially when you know it's out because there was a storm and in 2 days it'll be back. Help your freaking neighbors, right? If you have a, you know, more food than you can keep cool, and we'll talk about how to do that in just a second too, cook it and feed people with it. You'll make friends, right? So having additional methods to cook with, I also have a product called the EcoZoom stove. I can cook with scrap wood. I've fried and made Maryland style crab cakes with it. I've cooked shrimp jambalaya with it, and it burns scrap wood. And you can almost always find piles of scrap wood. Store some if you're going to rely on it. I also have a product called the Jamaican coal pot. They're hard to find here in America, but they're a great way to cook secondary. But have a secondary means of cooking. Just, and I'd say more than one plan for this. If you think you're going to cook on your grill, and your grill doesn't have a side burner, and you're storing foods that are easy to prepare with boiled water, try boiling a pot of water on a gas grill without a side burner and watch how much energy you waste. If your grill doesn't have a side burner and you don't want to buy a new grill, but you want to have the ability to cook in a pot or a pan efficiently, go to a sporting goods store and buy one of the devices that are designed either for frying fish or frying a turkey, one of the propane stands that you put pots onto, and you can take your propane tank and hook it up to that. Much more efficient. I mean, extremely efficient, very affordable, lots of power. If you need to boil a lot of water, like you're trying to heat up a bathtub with cold water from your pool, and you want to boil like a 5-gallon pot of water to heat that up, it'll do it for you. It'll do it for you quick. That's why I use it for brewing beer. I have one of those big stands like that runs off of propane, and I can bring 5 gallons of water to a boil in about 20 minutes. That doesn't sound like really fast, but boy, it's a lot faster than any other way that you're going to do it. And you don't need to bring it to a boil. You can bring it to 150, 160 degrees and heat up a bathtub of water to at least take a bath in, right? So these are some, and in fact, I would say it's more like 15 minutes anyway. But these are some things to be thinking about with being able to cook. I really think it makes sense to consider both a generator and a backup power system. Stephen Harris has been on the show on both of these subjects. We did hours and hours on both subjects. I'm not going to go deep into it today. I'm going to give you my basic overview of a generator. If you don't have a lot of money and a large budget, buy a small generator, learn how to use it, get some extension cords, and get the three-way plugs that Steve recommends. They're the orange ones that you can buy in any store. You can put them together and make lots and lots of outlets out of, and learn to at least run your refrigerator, your TV set, some basic lights and stuff off that small generator. Eventually buy a larger generator, some that were in the number of 5K or larger. With that, you can run a refrigerator and a deep freezer at the same time. You can run a window unit air conditioner. You can run a TV set. You can run an awful lot out off of a 5K generator simultaneously. It would be best to get a large enough generator that you can put in a bypass switch, have this done by a licensed electrician, where you can hook it up to your house and start it up and run the systems of your home. Unless you get a really large generator, you can't run all the systems in your home. But many times you can run any of the systems in your home, which means if you want the hot water heater to heat up, don't turn the stove on. And you can take a shower every once in a while. You can run your furnace burner and things like that. Central air is probably off the table unless you're looking at a very large-scale standby backup generator. But, you know, there's ways around that with fans, opening windows, etc. So I really think that it'll also make sense to make part of your blackout kit as you move it to more advanced fans and LED lights. Whether that's floor lamps with the little LED lights or what have you, they're low draw devices. You can run lots of stuff, have lots of light. You can run your cable box, your TV. I know people, when they think about preparedness, they're thinking, well, I'm not worried about watching Nickelodeon. All right, on the third day of a blackout with your children running around, going crazy, everybody's hot, everybody's irritable, because I'm telling you, even with these backup systems in place, it ain't the same as when the grid's on, you would cry to have Nickelodeon come on your TV and cause them to sit down and stop freaking out and be happy for a while and eat some popcorn that you made on the gas popper or whatever. All right, I'm telling you, you wouldn't believe how valuable it will be to you at that point. The best way to be able to do those types of things is with a mid-sized to large generator. You can get a mid-sized generator. I have a Troy-built 6500 generator. It runs like a champ. We paid $500 for it. I would say, and my wife, I can't see her because she's in her office and there's a wall between us, but I know she can hear me, and I guarantee you when I say the best investment that we've made in our preps in the past 2 years has been that generator, her head right now is nodding up and down. She just laughed, so I know it, okay? I guarantee you if you get a generator and you ever use it, you will love the fact that you made that investment. It is one of the best investments you can make. There's other things we can do. You can build battery backup systems. They'll run a lot of things. I recommend that in addition to a generator. You can get a good 800-watt backup inverter to hook up to your car, and you can do a lot with that. Those are great first steps. The long-term plan, in my view, should include a generator. It will make your life happier when you need it, I promise you. It's one of the places I say go ahead and make the investment, $500-$600. It's worth it. It's worth it. If you don't have it, then have a plan to get by. A get-by plan, a couple extension cords, an 800-watt inverter that you can get for about $50, some plug modules so you can run multiple things, and your car. Keep some extra gas for your car. We'll get to that in a second. Your car idles. You have to open the hood. Clip the inverter to your battery. You cannot plug this into your cigarette lighter. I don't care if it's an 800-watt inverter with a cigarette lighter plug on it. If you put that in your cigarette lighter plug and you try to pull 400 watts across it, one of two things will happen. It either won't work or you'll blow the fuse in your car, or both. Okay? So you have to hook to your battery terminals with the alligator clamps that come with the inverter, but that'll work just fine to provide you with enough power to run your refrigerator for 2 or 3 hours. Then turn the refrigerator off and run the TV for a couple hours with maybe the cable box or a DVD going. But that is, at best, a stopgap measure. That's your first step. And then you have that inverter with you everywhere you go with your vehicle. So now you have portable power. If you really want to build a sophisticated backup power system and you have a pickup truck, I recommend that you build the battery backup system that Stephen Harris sells videos on how to do. I'm building one as soon as we get to Texas. It's one of my first projects. You've got lots of portable power. You can put a 1,300 or a 1,600-watt inverter on that. It's constantly charging, two big golf cart batteries in there. You've got a portable power station then that goes with you anywhere. That's where I'm taking my battery backup to. I think it's a better solution than just having a couple marine batteries sitting around the house. But if that's what you've got and you got a good battery charger and you keep it charged off the grid while the power's up, you've got something. My point here, have some means of producing electricity for at least a day or two to keep your flashlight batteries, your cell phones, and all that at a minimum charged up. Car chargers are lifesavers in these situations. Very seldom will your house be without power and your car not run at the same time. Okay? The next thing I want to talk about today is supplemental heat and cooling. I talked about it a lot already, but if you have a generator, go get yourself a decent window unit air conditioner. Pick a room in your home that has as much convenience for you guys as possible. And even with a small generator, you can run a small window unit air conditioner. And that is where you are living in the middle of summer until the power comes back on. And it will make your life a lot better. To not sit and sweat. Fans and things like that are good ideas to keep the rest of the home cool, but basically creating a cool room to live in, and if the whole family has to bunk in there at night to be able to sleep comfortably, and depending on where you live, that might not be, if you live in northern New Hampshire, you're going, why do I care about this? That's fine. You better have supplemental heat, and if you live there, you probably do. As I said yesterday, a lot of these things that you'll hear and go, I already do that, it's very situational to where you live, okay? The people in New Hampshire that don't worry about the heat, you can have a heat wave too, and it might just be when you lose power. It's a good idea to have some method to keep cool. The same with heat, but with, to keep warm. But I can't tell you how important the cooling is. I really can't, because I don't know exactly how it would apply to your life, but I can tell you there are situations where a person can get into a situation where if you can't cool them down, they very well could die. And if that happens during a situation where the grid's down, you can't get them to a hospital or something like that, that's the only thing you can do is try to keep them cool. Heat stroke ain't no joke. And especially the elderly and children, every year when we have heat waves in different parts of the country, you hear about, you know, there's been 7 deaths this year. Of the 7, 6 will be old people in their homes that didn't have air conditioning. Again, it may be that you have an elderly family member that you have to bring into your home during this period of time. It may be that you've become aware of an elderly person lives in your neighborhood that you didn't know about till yesterday during this period of time. It may be a child, an infant as well. Johnny Max, who runs the Self-Sufficient Homestead podcast, he's a grandfather, and they had his daughter and his granddaughter come to his house during the outage after one of the hurricanes in South Texas. The baby was a month old. He said, I can't tell you how good it felt to know that I could keep that kid safe, because as soon as the hurricane passed through, the temperatures went up into multiple triple digits. And the humidity down there is like 90%. 90% humidity, 110 degrees, and an infant ain't no good for nobody. So these are things we have to think about in addition to just convenience. Because the first rule of survival, don't die, right? If you die, you broke that rule, it's over, out, done. And that includes all the people you care about and love. And there's these weaknesses that people have that make them more susceptible. That's why I think heat and cooling is really important. If nothing else, lots of fans and the ability to run them. Generator will do, fans all day, and then some. The next thing, though, is heating. I'll tell you that kerosene heaters are worth their weight in gold in a situation where the grid power's down. We use them very safe. You know, people worry about their safety. We use them in Pennsylvania. We had 2 of them during a job loss to help save money, because kerosene was cheap at the time and electric baseboard heat was not. We used them right through the Pennsylvania winter. We had no problems with them. There's certain safety precautions. Basically, read the box and do what it says. But they are extremely efficient at producing heat. If I still lived in a northern climate where it was a bigger issue, I'd have at least 2 of them now. Another thing that you can get are the Mr. Heaters, the Big Buddy and the Little Buddy heaters. Those are 2 great particular products. I'm fine with any portable heater. The reason I like the Mr. Heater products, I know they work, I own them, and they have tip over and they have low oxygen shutoff. That means if you get into a situation where you're reducing the oxygen in the room, the heater will shut itself off. Or if you or the dog or the kids knock it over, it will shut itself off. Any heater that you get that uses propane to heat indoors, you want those 2 features. These work great. They run off the 1-pound cans. They'll also, with an adapter hose, run off of the 5-gallon tanks like your gas grill does. Those are great. Fireplaces. Fireplaces are okay for supplemental heating, and they're not very good. Those of you that, you know, you start that warm fire and the whole room warms up and all, understand that's the fire adding to what's already there. If you start a fire in a house with all of the power off, the first thing it will do is start to warm up the room the fireplace is in, and it will drop the temperature in all the adjoining rooms. That fire is pulling air through the house, right? It has to let the smoke go up the chimney. A very small percentage, probably 10% of the heat, is radiated out into the room. The other 90% of the heat goes up the chimney, and when it goes up the chimney, it has to have some source to take it with it. Cold air goes down, so it pulls the air across your floor, and then that cold air gets converted to hot air and leaves your house. It has to come from somewhere. It's basically like turning on a draw fan. If you turn a draw fan on in your living room, your peripheral rooms will cool down because they've got the air flowing out of them. So a fireplace is a limited utility. That said, if you're all hanging out in the living room with the fireplace on, everybody's going to probably be pretty warm. They make a back reflector. It's just basically a piece of sheet metal that goes in the back of your fireplace. Part of it is to help protect the back wall of the fireplace from heat damage long term, as the fire bricks, you know, eventually wear down some from the heat. But one of the big advantages, and we have one of these, is that helps reflect a lot of heat out. So I'd really recommend, if you're going to rely on a fireplace at all, that you get one of these back reflectors. They're about $40. We have found that when you put it in the fireplace, we don't have a very large fireplace. It's a piece of metal that goes into these 2 feet. The 2 feet kind of take up some space where your coal bed is. I took them off and just put them outside and stuck it back there and put the grate up against it, and their feet aren't there anymore, and it stands up perfectly. It works better that way for me. It might work better that way for you. The big thing is that metal reflector back there is going to push a little more of the heat out of the fireplace and make it a little bit more efficient. If you really want to rely on your fireplace for backup heat, I recommend basically a wood stove insert. It's about halfway between a fireplace and a wood stove. It's not as efficient as a wood stove, but it's much more efficient than just a fireplace. These can be had for a couple $1,000s professionally installed with a sleeve up your chimney to change how much heat is allowed out and things like that. And if you live in a cold climate and you don't want to do any, you know, a full wood stove, this is probably worth its weight in gold to you. A real wood stove is extremely efficient. We're talking about a freestanding stove where the heat radiates off the side, the top, etc. If you live in a really cold climate, it's probably the way to go. We have one at our new home in Texas. It probably won't get that much use. It just doesn't get that cold that often. The disadvantage of a wood stove: if you like a fire for its ambiance and a little bit of warmth and stuff like that, and you have a day where you don't really need it, but it helps and it kind of feels good, it looks cool, and you fire your wood stove up on a day like that, you're going to end up opening windows because it is so efficient at radiating heat. And if you dampen it down, there's really no point, right? So that's something to consider as well. The big thing, though, is remember that it's easier to heat or cool a person than to heat or cool a home. Sitting in front of a fan is easier than trying to cool down an entire room. An electric blanket that's running off your generator is easier than trying to heat an entire house. And the smaller the space that the person is in, the less heat you need to keep them warm. So in a truly dire situation where it's really cold and you have no backup heat, what I would do is drag the mattresses to a central place and basically build a little fort out of your mattresses with pillows on the side and create a little hidey hole. Put everybody in there at night. You'll stay amazingly warm if you do that. If everybody just bundles up in a blanket and lays on the couch, it's not going to be anywhere near as efficient. Creating that little kind of a fortress for yourself underneath that mattress will let all that body heat get reflected back. So remember, always, it's easier to heat a person or cool a person than to heat or cool a room. And that'll open up a lot of different ideas for you, because I can only go so deep into each issue here on today's episode. The next thing is, it's easier to make ice than cool air. Everybody wants to keep the refrigerator running. Steve Harris recommends these little portable ice makers that cost about $150, $160 on Amazon. They'll run great off your battery backup system for a while, especially if you have a way to recharge it. They'll run great off of your small generators. Even a really small generator will run one of these. If you're making ice during a blackout and you have a cooler, you can keep your food fresh for as long as you like. And you're also going to be able to do something, again, that I keep going back to: help your neighbors. If I have my generator running, I can keep all my food cold in my refrigerator. If I also have an ice maker sitting on my chest, I can give a bag of ice to my neighbor once a day to help them get through it. And then maybe they'll listen to me when I want to talk to them in the future about being a little bit more prepared, because I've helped them get through something that sooner or later we're all going to go through: a blackout. It's just something that you can pretty much count on. You're going to have an extended blackout at some period of your life unless you die very young. You almost talk to no adult over the age of 40. Go, you ever go 2 days without power or more? And they go, no, never happened. Those that do, you live in a cocoon, you better break it, because sooner or later reality is going to break it for you. But that's another great thing to think about when it comes to keeping food cold or keeping even people cool. It's easier to make ice than it is to cool air. And I want you to think about the efficiency and everything that you're planning on for preparedness. We have this surplus of energy. Everything we've talked about so far today goes back to energy. We have such a surplus of energy in America today. You can turn on everything in your home. You can turn your furnace on. You can turn on your hot water heater. You can turn on every light, everything, and it'll all run. And in a backup situation, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to have to pick and choose. And we live with this surplus mentality, so we don't worry about efficiency anymore. Yeah, we buy the Energy Star appliance because it'll cost us less money, but we're not really thinking about efficiency in our procedures on a daily basis. So here's the understanding: the efficiency of ice versus the efficiency of a freezer. Open your freezer, stick your hand in your freezer, don't touch anything, have it suspended in the air, close the door as best you can, count to 30. And think about how your hand feels. Now, get a cooler full of ice. Jam your hand into the ice, count to 30, and see if it's still there at the end of 30, or if you go, I got the point, you pull your hand out. Contact with ice or icy water cools much faster. Here's another, you don't want your hand in the freezer or the ice water, I understand. Get yourself a couple sodas, or if you're a beer drinker like me, a couple beers. Take a bowl or a bucket of ice, stick the beer into the ice. Warm beer, right? Take the bottle of beer, stick it in your freezer. Close the door of the freezer, set the bucket of ice to the side, set a timer for 10 minutes. 10 minutes, go drink the beer out of, take a drink of the beer out of the freezer or the Coke in the freezer. 10 minutes, take it out of the ice and taste it. You'll understand immediately the difference in efficiency in using ice or water versus air to cool things and keep them cold. Next, store gas, kerosene, diesel, propane, any fuel that you have based on your needs. If you have an alcohol stove, store alcohol. If you have a propane grill, store propane. Again, with Steve Harris, we talked a lot about fuel storage, so I can just refer you back to those shows. I'll put links in today's show notes. But let me give you my method for storing gas or diesel fuel for your vehicles that can also be used for generators and other things. I want to do this also from a standpoint of, you don't have an unlimited budget, you're phasing your way into this a little at a time. How do you do this without, you know, breaking the bank, especially with the cost of fuel anymore? So pick one day this month that you're going to step into fuel storage. Go to the store and buy a 5-gallon gas can. When you go to fill your car up the next time, fill the gas can and write a big number 1 on the gas can. Take it home to your garage or your shed or wherever you're going to store your fuel and stick it down. Next month, about the same day of the month, do that again. Next month, about the same day of the month, do that again, except this time write a 2, and the third month write a 3, and the fourth month write a 4. Okay? You now have 4 5-gallon cans of gas. I would keep doing this till you get to number 12. You got 60 gallons of gas. But 4 will give you 20. That's a lot of fuel in reserve, more than most people have. That'll run a generator for a long time. That'll get you at least through a week-long crisis, because you're not going to be driving all around your car joyriding now, are you? All right, now, on month 5, if you're going to stop with 4 cans, take can number 1, dump it in your car. Put the can in the back of your car, the back of your truck, go to fill up. When you fill up, fill the can up and the car up. Now, here's the thing. If you're only going to do 4 cans, after your 4th can, filling up your car won't cost you a penny more than it has at any other time in your life other than the price of gas going up. Because the 5 gallons going in the can already is in the car. If you take, you know, if you want to do 60 gallons and you have enough money to get there faster, do it in 6 months. Do it twice a month. But eventually build up that reserve of fuel and just put numbers on the can and just rotate it through. You will have no worries. You don't need stable. You don't need any. I mean, it's good to use these additives to store your fuel long term. But if you're dumping a can in once or twice a month, and that fuel's never getting more than 6 months old or 8 months old at maximum in your home, that fuel's going to be just fine, especially when mixed with new fuel. And understand that the oldest can that might be 6 months old is 6 month old fuel, but the can you put there yesterday is only a day old. So even if you're using that fuel, you can blend it if you have any concerns. If you run a diesel, just do the same thing with cans that are marked for diesel. And if you have gas and diesel, do both. Propane, it's not an issue. You could get, if you have the space and room for it, 1,000-gallon tank of propane. It's really big if you get one that big. You could fill it up with propane. You could turn the valve off so you're not using it. You could go away for 10 years and come back and turn that valve on, and that propane will burn the same as it would the day they put it in there. It's infinite in its storage capacity. It ain't going nowhere. So it's one of the best fuels that we can store. But store fuel based on your needs. But I would tell you that anything less than 20 gallons of a primary fuel is too little. That doesn't mean you have to have 20 gallons tomorrow, but have a plan to phase into it like I just gave you. Keep your vehicle tanks full and use it to rotate your stored fuel, which I already have said. But if you're driving down the road and you're going past a gas station, you got a couple minutes to stop and fill up, and there's an empty pump especially, and you look at your tank and it says a half a tank, go fill up now. Don't wait till it's on E, like my wife does. And then she says, why don't you take my truck? And I take her truck and it's on E and I got to fill it up and that's the scam and that's the plan. And it's not just so that your significant other is not inconvenienced by having to fill your vehicle for you. It's because if I have a full vehicle and 20 gallons of fuel, that's better than an almost empty vehicle and 20 gallons of fuel. It's a lot better. Right? So keep your vehicle's fuel. That's all I'm going to do on energy, even though that was, you know, God, I covered 40 minutes on energy today. So I'm going to keep going, though, and even if we run long on this part two, we're going to cover the whole thing today. The next thing we need to talk about is security. Security is something that, as I said yesterday, we overlook it because you can live without security your entire life if you're lucky and get away with it. I mean, really, there are people that have lived their entire life and never worried that anybody would ever do anything to hurt them. They don't lock their doors. They don't lock their car doors. I know people that leave their keys in their car. There are people that, you know, will give their social security number out walking down the street over a cell phone with people around them. And they'll live that way their whole life, and they'll grow to be old, and they'll die, and they'll never have a problem. It's called luck. It's something you don't bet on luck. If I bet on luck, I wouldn't have a business. I'd just play the lottery every day and keep getting richer and richer because the luck would play out, right? It doesn't work that way. And this is why this is so dangerous that we can get away without security for so long, because it lets us get into a false sense of security. And the only reason we can get away with it today, 300 years ago, you didn't live that way. You knew there was danger because there wasn't a cop on every corner and there wasn't a society that's been organized and engineered to be complacent and compliant, and it wasn't necessarily considered that you were that ostracized if you hurt somebody. Right? There were people that was their whole reputation was based on the fact that they hurt people. And they liked their reputation being that way. We still have people like that today, but it's a little bit harder to get away with than it was 300 years ago. So we have two things working against us. One is luck, right, and in making us have a false sense of security. And the other is that society provides a lot of our security for us. So when that security that's being provided for us either fails due to a breakdown or just fails due to the fact that cops can't be everywhere. The average response time to a 911 call in America today is 19 minutes. Ask yourself how many times somebody that wants you dead can kill you in 19 minutes. And then ask yourself how many times they need to kill you for it to count. Okay, so there's reasons this breaks down. Or the luck runs out. The person that's lived in blissful ignorance their whole life, the luck runs out. This is why this is so important to me. If you're ever in one of these situations where somebody's trying to hurt or kill you or worse, ladies, or somebody's beating someone you love to death in front of you and there's nothing you can do about it, I can promise you one of the things you're going to think is, if I only lock the door, if I was only armed, if I was only prepared, if, so, and I don't know what to fill the blank in for you, because I won't know the situation, but I know you'll think it, and it'll probably be something that was pretty simple to do before it happened. And it might be as simple as if I had only locked the door. At least we would have, even if we would have got in, we knew he was trying to get in, we could have been prepared for it, instead of having him walk in. One time you walk to your car without your keys ready and a means of defense, and just as you open, you finally get the door open and you're fumbling, you're not thinking, and somebody shoves you into it. One time you open the door for somebody you don't recognize and your gut tells you not to, they kick the door in as soon as you open it and you have no means of defense. One time is enough. And that's why this has to be addressed. Security here is not just about being prepared for Armageddon. It's about every single day, and there's people out there that will kill you and will hurt you, and you better expect it. The first thing you can do that's so simple, and some people are great about this and some people are terrible, the door stays locked at all times. The door stays locked at all times, even without it being a threat to your life or limb. I told this story recently. I'm telling a real quick version of it again. There was a guy on a talk show. I don't remember the show. Professional burglar, professional cat burglar, guy ripped off big time people like the Kellogg's family, like from Kellogg's cereal. That's the level this guy operated at. He broke in while people were home. He never broke into a home when no one was home. You know why? Security system's off when you're home. He'd case the house, he'd pick a good target. He would love to break in when the husband and wife were home, and I'll tell you why in a second, because they could argue with each other about a locked door. So he would wait until they made the mistake of leaving the door unlocked, either front or back door. He would slip in. He would go immediately to the master bedroom. This guy didn't want to hurt anybody. He was just a thief. As soon as he got it, he would make sure he cased it, make sure nobody was in there. He'd go in the master bedroom. He would close the door. He would lock it. That's where money, guns, high-dollar jewelry, everything of value in a house that can be quickly removed without, you know, dragging a sled down the road behind you is usually in the master bedroom, is the way that he looked at it. And while you're arguing with each other, you lock the door, no, you lock the door, no, you lock the door, he's gone. You know, and then the next day, when mom goes in, because dad says let's go out to dinner, and she goes to put on that beautiful diamond necklace that her mother left her, that's worth $5,000, and she's never going to sell it because it had more value to her than it was her mom's or her grandmother's than even the dollar value, and she can't find it, and it's always in that one spot in the jewelry box, and you start looking and other things are missing, and then you look for the cash stash that's kept under the mattress or whatever, and then dad looks for his 45 that he keeps in the closet, and all of that stuff's gone, and you report it stolen. It's already been pawned. You're reporting it a day later, and it's already gone. So just the concept of theft alone is enough of a reason to have a rule that the doors are locked and stay locked. You also need to start working more on your situational awareness. And I usually don't say you have to do anything, because I know that I don't know you and I don't know what level you're at. I don't know if you're prepared for a day or a year, but I can tell you that there's no such thing as being done working on your situational awareness. Perform little games. Play with your spouse. It's a great thing to do when you drive somewhere together. Each of you try to see two or three things that are a little bit unusual along the way, and then tell the other one what you saw and ask if they saw it too. It'll start to turn your mind on to just paying attention. When you're pumping gas in your car, if you have earbuds in and you're listening to me, shut me off while you're pumping gas into your car. If I'm a guy that wants to mug somebody, steal them, put a knife in their back and take their wallet, there's no better time than when you're pumping gas. You've got your wallet out. You're not really paying attention. Put some earbuds in and you're just blinking. Hey, I'm not paying attention at all here. I won't hear you when you sneak up behind me. Right? Don't put yourself in these compromised situations. If you are going somewhere and your gut says turn around and go the other way or take a different route, trust your gut. If you're ever somewhere and you feel a little bit cold, remember the movie I See Dead People? The way they describe feeling when a dead person's around? That's not what you feel when dead people are around. That's when you feel what danger's around. Right? Big game hunters describe this. They're in a blind waiting for the leopard. They don't hear anything. They don't see anything. They don't smell anything. They have no idea why, but the hair on your arm goes up. There's a feeling in your stomach. There's a coolness on the back of your neck, and you know he's there. And then you see this silhouette go up a tree to the bait. Or you hear a twig snap because he finally made a mistake, and it's behind you, and he's stalking you. And how do you know that it's innate? It's built into ourselves as human beings. There was a time not that long ago when you were walking around, you were always two things, predator and prey. And we'd like to believe that there's no big things with no big teeth that eat us anymore. And there's no mean, evil men that would kill you just to kill you. But both of those things are true. They do happen. And the part of you that can sense them is still there. Trust it. Situational awareness to trust your gut. Keep multiple means of defense in your home. We have pepper spray Velcroed under tables, behind window curtains, all over the place. We all know how to use the guns that are in the home. We know what guns are in the home. We have guns. We're trained to use them. We know what to do with them. I hate to say this, but if you break into my home, the last sound you're probably going to hear in your life is a loud bang. And I'll feel bad that I had to take a life, but I'm not going to be apologetic for it. Because you shouldn't break in my home. The more homes like that in America, the less break-ins there will be. I'm not going to do a whole show on firearms. I do 10 shows on firearms. Get trained, get equipped, and practice your Second Amendment right. Do it now. And if you have this feeling like, well, I don't really know if I want, learn to do it right, be safe, and you namby-pamby idiots out there going, guns aren't safe in the home. I'll tell you what's not safe in the home. Somebody killing you, or beating you, or raping you, or stomping on the face of your children while you stand there and do nothing because you're outclassed, outmatched, and you can't do anything about it because you didn't want to be politically incorrect. Don't let yourself be in that situation. If you have a fear of firearms, good. It will keep you from doing something stupid. Go get trained until the fear becomes respect, and then practice your right to self-defense, own a weapon, and be prepared to use it if you need to. And don't believe the political BS out there that tells you you're more likely to shoot a loved one than a bad guy. 1.5 million crimes were stopped in America last year by armed citizens, by a statistic that I saw this morning. You don't hear about it because they don't want you to hear about it, but I'll tell you what, there's nothing that makes a bad guy more scared than a good guy with a gun. So make that part of your self-defense, and I'll leave that at that for today. Know when you need to go to a higher threat level, and trust your gut with this, like I said earlier. What I mean, though, is there's a way that you conduct yourself, basic situational awareness, basic security, basic protocols, when you walk to your car, looking around before you get in it, things like that, on a daily basis. If the power's been out for a week, don't act like it hasn't been out for a week. Don't act as though there's no greater threat. Don't act like because you live in the suburbs, in a nice neighborhood with a gate around it, that you're safe, because you're not. Right? If I'm a scumbag, and I want to hurt and steal and rob and maim, and the power's out, and I usually, you know, kind of keep myself in kind of the lower thug area of town, because I know there's higher security in these other areas, but I know that security's been compromised, guess where I'm going to go, because the shopping's better there, if you get my drift. All right, so understand that there's times to change your protocols. There's times to just say, you know what, when anybody leaves the house, there's going to be at least two people. There's times for that. I won't get into all of the criteria. I'm just saying open your mind to the fact that there's times you have to start conducting yourself differently, at least for a time. And there are times to say, you know what, no one leaves the house alone. You don't even go out to pick a tomato off a vine without somebody else going out there with you. If there's riots going on a few miles away and you think, well, it's not here yet, you don't know that. So just be open to that and be prepared to have additional protocols in place when that happens. I think some additional things you can look at, a dog, a little yippy-yappy dog, if not a great big mean dog. Just the fact that there's noise and an alert is huge. And dogs can hear what you'll never hear. They can see what you'll never hear, and they can smell what you'll never smell. And a dog that has that in them to at least say, hey, something's there, and start yapping or barking, will never let you down. It will never fail you. Window films, the 3M window film and other films you put on the window, you can't see it, it's just invisible. You try to break the window, it's almost impossible to break the window out. It's a great security investment, especially for windows on a first floor, windows in a door where somebody could reach in and unlock. You don't necessarily have to do it all, but your primary breach areas, good place to add that. And any other enhanced security. The door sentinel is something I've mentioned that helps keep the door. We use a product called Fake TV we just found. We think that's great. Anything gives the illusion that people are home. Is less likely to be burglarized when you're not home. The most dangerous situation you can probably get into with a home invasion is someone invades your home while you're not there. You come home unaware that they are there, and you surprise them. Criminals that really do not want to physically hurt somebody, because there are criminals like that. They just want to take your stuff. Put in that situation, it'll often trigger that predator instinct, and I gotta kill this guy now, or I gotta hurt this guy now because I don't want to get caught. The guy that just planned on breaking in and getting out, surprised like that can turn very dangerous very, very fast. So keeping people out when you're not there is almost as important as keeping them out when you are there. Take some basic self-defense training and understand this. You can be a third-degree black belt in Taekwondo and some big dude off a motorcycle can still kick your ass. It can happen all the time. Self-defense training at least gets you in the mindset of being willing to fight back and having the mentality that I'm going to fight back. But a lot of self-defense training, if you believe that, well, since I've been trained, now I'm prepared, it can be actually detrimental because you become too convinced of, you know, this technique some guy taught you or something. I think it's still a great entry-level step to at least take basic first aid, self-defense training with some level of sparring and grappling where you actually have some level of combat with another person. I think it's important just so you understand the dynamics of what's going on. I think this is a lot why men are more prepared for this than women. Boys wrestle. Right? Little girls don't usually, some do, right? I'm not going to say none of them do, but when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old, we always wrestled with each other. I had friends that, like, you know, when you got somebody to where you could just punch them in the face, we would just like, gah! And like, you know, stop your hand like a half inch from their face and then pull it back and go, ah, I would have got you, right? And that always could have happened, right? And that has this, you know, men have this preponderance. It's why women, you can get pissed at me. But when it comes to a physical altercation, it's that plus the physical size difference that generally puts you in a place where you're outclassed. And guys, this applies to you too. The guy that's been fighting every day of his life, he's been jumped into a gang, he's been beaten, he's been kicked as part of his daily life, has an advantage when he's fighting you, even if you're trained, and even if you are, let's say, a little bit stronger than him. He still has an advantage because he wants it more. And he's willing to do things that maybe you haven't considered. And this is why I think that the primary means for you to develop physical self-defense is mental, not physical. I believe that you need to develop a mindset of meeting violence with superior violence. If you mean to shove me, I mean to shove your head into the ground and kick your teeth out. All right? Don't shove me. Now, I'm not saying if somebody... This can go the wrong way. I don't want you to get the wrong impression of what I'm saying. I've seen idiots that if they're walking through a shopping mall, somebody bumps into their shoulder like, hey, what's... That is not self-defense, right? That's being an arrogant asshole that belongs in Jersey Shore or something like that. What I'm talking about is legitimate. You're aggressing on me, and you shove me. And I think it might, you know, I don't think it's going to go any further. I'm still going to try to mitigate, right, to de-escalate the confrontation. If I think that shove is going to result in the next thing coming is a punch, I'm coming at you 110%, and I'm not stopping until I know you're incapacitated. Most people do not think that way. Let me tell you something. You have to. The best way to stop physical confrontation is that your response overwhelms the attacker with its aggression. Right? This is why self-defense like Krav Maga are so valuable. That's why it's considered one of the best methods of self-defense out there. It's not the techniques, it's the mentality. Right? It's training where part of the training is like five guys beating on you and you're in the middle having to deal with them all. Now there's some control and it's sparring, but it's also very realistic. It's that mindset. So the mindset has to be, if you're coming at me with a violent magnifier of 4, I'm coming back with a 12. And if I can muster 13, that's what you're getting. Now, when you start to bring weapons into the equation and somebody shoves you, you don't pull out a gun and shoot them. That's why it's actually better to have a gun. Right? Because if you do that, I can push you off me, I can step back, and I can warn you. And if you don't take the warning and you advance, I can draw down on your ass. If you don't stop now you're going to get shot. But I will actually have a better chance of not doing you serious harm if I'm armed in that situation than if I'm not. Because if you attack me and I'm not armed, to protect my life, I have to assume that you mean to hurt me bad. And that means I need to hurt you worse so that you're not capable of doing it. Now, there are places to use your judgment. If the person that wants to attack me and hurt me is a 12-year-old kid, you're not going to find me sitting on his chest pounding his face in, right? But you know what? Even the person that you look at and think isn't that big a threat physically, you better be careful because you don't know. You also need to understand this. We did some training with Valery Azanov, the guy from the KGB. I had a couple of really big guys. I'm talking 280-pound MMA fighter and a 280-pound former lineman for Texas University. And I had them in this whole, you know, typical young male bullshit, going to fight each other in a bar. And they, you know what? They both had enough of it in their head. They immediately, once they started playing with it a little bit, they went right into character. It looked just like what you'd see in a bar. And I walked up behind one of them and I drug an 8-inch cold steel plastic rubber training knife across his back from one side to the other, and then poked him where I would have poked him in the left kidney and then up under into the diaphragm with it and kept walking on. And he didn't even realize I did it. And when I called him to break, I said, this is what just happened to you. While you were fighting with him, his buddy stabbed you in the kidneys, punctured your diaphragm, and slit open the other side of your body, cutting into your intestines. You're dead. You're dead and you don't even know it. Security has to have that understanding in it. And I'm telling you, those of you that are listening to this, that this has been shared with you, and this is getting a little graphic and a little real for you today, and you're going, this guy was making a lot of sense up till now, this is the part you better listen to. Those of you that think, well, that never happens here, please listen to the end, because I'm going to tell you something you don't want to hear at the end, but you need to hear it. You want to survive. It's not just about what if the apocalypse comes. It's about what if this type of thing that happens to somebody every day happens to you. How will you respond to it? That doesn't mean you walk around paranoid. That doesn't mean you walk around like you're ready to kick somebody's butt. That means you're just aware. And awareness is 90% of the battle. And you have a plan to respond. That's the other 10%. This is the last one. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your eyes open. And keep your mouth shut. Let me say that again. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your eyes open. And keep your mouth shut. Every time I do a video on YouTube that's about anything to do with security, somebody always has to mouth off. The last guy was a guy who calls himself the resident badass. He said, I agree with everything you said, but if I met you face to face, I'd probably kick you into oblivion. Which is just obviously somebody with a mental problem. Okay? People that shoot their mouth off, they always end up losing in the end. So when I talk about security, I'm talking about that aspect of it. Don't try to look tough. Don't try to engage anybody. Whenever there's a potential for conflict, always begin with a policy of de-escalation. I'm going to avoid the conflict if at all possible. You think that comes from a state of weakness because you've been conditioned by society to believe that. Let me tell you something. When you're carrying a tool capable of taking somebody's life, you're in a superior position. And it's more important, not less important, to de-escalate at that point, isn't it? Don't you think if you're carrying a loaded 45 on your back and some guy just wants to fight with you, do you have an added responsibility to, if there is any way to avoid the conflict, to attempt to do so? Most rational people would say yes. Is it because you're afraid or because you're weak? It's because you're strong. De-escalation. Mitigation. Conflict. So I want to de-escalate it. Now I want to try to mitigate the conflict. If you're going to force me into conflict after that, that's where I'm with violence being met with superior violence. But I'm always going to start with mitigation. And those of you guys that think you're tough and you can handle the situation, remember my little story about the guy getting, you know, the rubber knife across his back. And think about it, when you are with a girlfriend, a wife, a situation like that, where someone else is around you and they're vulnerable. Just because you're going to be able to take care of yourself doesn't mean you have an added responsibility for those around you. So consider that. Now, the other side of keep your mouth shut, we're talking about preparedness and all. That's great, sharing the message and all. But when it comes down to, I have all this security, I have this, I have all this food, keep your mouth shut. I know you're sitting there going, well, this guy does it every day. I'm a podcaster. This is my business. Someone has to stand up and do it. There's no need for your neighbors to know that you have 90 days worth of food in your house until you decide that you need to share some of it with them and in a given situation. So that's the other side of keep your mouth shut. Don't try to be a badass, because there's always a bigger badass, and don't tell people more than they need to know. This is so much bigger than just this straight security, though. If you're having a conversation with somebody, like someone you're ordering service from, or a car guy selling a car, or anything like that, stop giving people information they don't need about you. Any level of information that can seem harmless can come back and bite you. Women, you're the worst about this. You like to chat. You like to have conversations. You're on the telephone ordering, cable TV or whatever, and you're telling people we're moving back to whatever or whatever. You don't know. Right, my wife's probably mad at me now, but seriously, people don't need to know all the details of your life, and it's better that they don't. 99% of the time, you're giving all this wonderful story that you think's important, and the person is hearing the teacher's voice on Charlie Brown. Wah, 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 wah. They're not paying attention. It's harmless. 1% can hurt you. Don't. Do it. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your eyes open. Keep your mouth shut. One more I'll addend to this, even though it's not in my notes, from Frank Sharp Jr. Don't do stupid places with stupid people, or don't go to stupid places with stupid people and do stupid things. You follow that rule, you'll stay out of 90% of the situations that people get themselves into. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to finish up today, even though this is long. Sanitation and health is something that, you know, we leave out of these five survival needs. We don't talk about it a lot in wilderness survival. You got to take a dump in wilderness survival. You find a tree, you dig a hole, you do it, it's done, right? And because you're one or two, if you have 20 people in the woods, you're probably not in a survival situation. Survival situations in the wilderness are you're lost. By the time you find 20 people, it's probably search and rescue bringing you out. So we don't have these collective problems with sanitation in the wilderness that we do. So when we try to do this correlation over and wilderness trainers start talking about urban, it's a place they often leave a hole. You can't do it because in your subdivision with 800 people or 800 houses with an average of 3 people each, that's 2,400 people taking a dump every day, urinating multiple times a day, producing trash, producing garbage. It's a problem. It needs to be addressed. There needs to be a plan for it in a grid down scenario. The first thing to understand, though, and this is I combine sanitation and health. This means treating illnesses as well, having first aid kits all in one, because it's integral. They lead to each other's problems. The number one problem in a disaster area that leads to sanitation and health problems is almost always water. And here's why. If I have a person that's about to die of dehydration and they're given a choice, even if they know it, of drinking water that will give them diarrhea or dysentery or something else or cholera or drinking no water at all, they'll drink the infected water every time. There's a point at which your body and your mind say, I got to drink, and you're going to do it. Right? And when you start looking at things like the Haitian earthquake, and the number one killer after the Haitian earthquake was diarrhea from contaminated water, especially in children and the elderly, it's directly proportional to that. So I already talked about water yesterday. So everything I said about water applies to this, and it's the number one way that you can avoid in a major, I'm talking like a Hurricane Katrina event here. And don't think that this stuff doesn't happen in America. Again, I'm holding on that till the end of this episode, but it has, right? Hurricane Andrew. You don't know if you're going to be on the edge of a disaster or the center of a disaster. And it doesn't take long for contaminated water to make you really sick and or kill you. So the water takes away a huge portion of it. The next thing is have a plan to deal with human waste. If you have a backyard and a shovel, you can handle that for a while. Right? You can only do it for so long, but you can dig a pretty big hole and you can take care of it that way. A simple stopgap measure is a toilet seat, a 5-gallon bucket, some garbage bags, and that blue stuff you put in portable toilets. It's gross, it's disgusting, but it'll work and it's sanitary. And as long as it's a short-term situation where at least the garbage trucks are going to roll again in another couple weeks, you can throw those bags out there and get rid of it that way. But have a plan for it. If you want a really long-term plan, consider a composting toilet. It won't make any difference to you whether the grid's up or down if you have one of those. The next thing is have a plan for basic bathing. Right with the water issue is people not being able to keep wounds clean, keep their bodies clean, keep funguses down, have lots of soap, deodorant, all of those things that we generally have one of, have a stockpile of those, not just your food. Think about a situation where you do have to bring some extended family in. You got 6 adults, 7 or 8 kids living in a 3-bedroom house, and you're out of shampoo and deodorant and soap. How much inconvenience, how much stink, how much nastiness is that, plus how much of a health risk is that? So that's something as well. Keep a decent supply of medical supplies on hand, both over-the-counter and maybe some prescription medications. And if you have maintenance medications that you're on, make sure you have at least a 90-day supply of them, specifically diabetics and things like that as well. I can only go so deep because this can become, again, a whole episode just on this. I'm trying to get you thinking in the right direction today. So a good supply of medical supplies and things like Imodium. Right? If you do have diarrhea in a grid down situation, $4 of Imodium saves a life. I know that the concept of somebody dying from diarrhea seems very divorced from us today, but it happens in rural parts of Mexico every day. And anatomically, physically, you are the same human being as that person that died yesterday from this. The only thing separating you from what killed them is you have good sanitation, and you have a situation where there's something that can be done with your waste and a good supply of water. If I take those things away from you, you are equalized with the person that died from diarrhea yesterday in a nanosecond. It doesn't take long. So we have to have all of these things in place. And I would include under these things like learning some stuff about herbal medicine and home remedies in addition to over-the-counter stuff. Having antibiotics is a good idea. I won't go deep into it today other than I will tell you that the antibiotics they sell for fish are the same antibiotics that your doctor prescribes for you. They're made in the same plant. They're in the same dosages per capsule. And it may be a good idea to lay some of those up as well. If you want to know more about health and sanitation, I really recommend the Doom and Bloom podcast by Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy to go into this stuff a lot deeper. But another thing I got to say is maintain your health on a daily basis. Take a freaking walk. All right. If you work in a job where you're in an office every day and you get an hour for lunch and your lunch is I go to the break room, I microwave my lunch, I sit down and eat it, and I go back to my desk. Take a freaking walk. Get up every morning, go outside your door, walk around the block. Functional fitness. Eat good quality food every day. Even though some of the stuff we talked about storing long term may not be the most healthy food, the food you're putting in your body every day should be healthy. Take care of yourself now so that you're healthy if something goes wrong. Take basic first aid and CPR training as a minimum. Have a basic understanding of things like how do I deal with dehydration? How do I know the difference between heat stroke and heat exhaustion? When do I need to get advanced medical help? What do I do when I know I need it but I can't get it? Get a copy of the book Where There Is No Doctor. Get a copy of Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy's book, The Doom and Bloom Survival Guide. With those two and some basic training, you'll be able to handle a lot of things. And I'm gonna stop on the sanitation and health there, even though I could go longer, because this is going to be a very long episode today and a very long series. But I want to start now at the end kind of wrapping this up. And if I had to do this again, I might actually put this part in the beginning, because it's some final thoughts on a lot of the whys, the why we're doing this. And if somebody shared this with you and you managed to make it all the way to the end, pat yourself on the back because you've done something most people that aren't already open to this won't do. You've opened your mind, you've listened, and you've learned, and you've considered some things you may have never considered before. Let me reinforce that for you here at the end, because I'm going to tell you, if this was shared with you, the person that shared it with you is not paranoid, they're not delusional, you haven't heard a damn thing about a black helicopter from me in about an hour and a half of, or 2.5 hours of information, and you won't either. This is a person that's concerned that you live in a world where most people aren't prepared for stuff that happens, and we need to have a plan. One thing you'll notice, though, is I didn't say at any time, I gave you a bunch of ideas, a bunch of ways, a bunch of products, a bunch of stuff, and said, or something like that. This is because your plan must be your plan. I do not have a survival plan or a preparedness plan for your family that is tick all these boxes and then you're done. You have a different lifestyle than I do. You have a different income than I do. You live in a different place than I do. You have a different risk tolerance than I do. You have different financial resources than I do. You have a different size home. You have a different set of passions and beliefs. And you have to build your plan based on your life and what's important to you and all the things I just said. So you have to take the information I've given you. Come back, listen to my other shows, get educated about these things, the threats, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And put it together in your lifestyle, your way. Because if I tell you, I do this and you should too, when you get to step 7 and it's not something you want to do, you won't do it, and you won't do 8 either, and you're done. You'll quit. Your plan has to be your plan. It's the only way it will work. And I am smart enough to know that and to not tell you if you don't do things everything the way that I said, you're wrong. That would be a mistake on my part. I will give you complete freedom as long as you will be open-minded to the fact that you need to be doing something and you need to be prepared. And that the average person is not just unprepared, but completely unprepared. And you don't want to be part of that group at a point where something does go wrong, whether it's national, nationwide collapse of the economy, which it's one of the things I'll tell you, that we're going to deal with it on some level at some point. Anybody can do math can figure that out. Or you just lost your job, or a tree fell in your house, or a tornado hit your neighborhood. Or there was flooding down the street that's not really affected you directly, but it has the power out and services are down. Right? Anything in between. You need to be prepared to deal with it and take care of yourself. And it seems daunting. I mean, I try to do the title of this, right, was From Zero to Prepared, Fast, Simple, and Low Cost. right? And then I end up with 2.5 hours of lecturing to be fast, simple, and low cost. So it seems overwhelming, even when we break it down to the most basics. I got good news for you. There's 52 weeks in a year, and one thing a week makes a big impact. If this week you put up the 5 gallons of fuel, next week you put together a blackout kit, next week you start coffee canning, next week you see how that works? Next week you learn some wild edibles around your home that you can forage for. The week after that you build a battery backup system. The week after that you step into a generator. The week after, and you just keep doing that. I hope nobody's taking notes and putting it into that order. I'm just pulling it random out of my butt. Right? The week after that, you start training your dog a little bit better to alert on noises. The week after that, you go take a basic training class for a few weeks in a community college. The week after that, you start working on your situational awareness. That's free, so we start doing it right away. But we put it down on a schedule. If you get a calendar and just write one thing you're going to do each week, you will be blown away at what you'll do in a year. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. And a lot of the expense is money you would have spent anyway. The best way I can explain that, yesterday I was talking about food storage. I'm talking about coffee canning and buying 2 cans of something instead of one. Once you get your stockpile of that built up, you go back to buying it only as needed and rotating it. You are going to buy all that stuff anyway. All you've done is pull the purchase forward in time a little bit. So that's not really a cash out. Like in the end, it saves you money because now I can pick and choose when I resupply. So I can resupply when I have a coupon, when there's a sale. So a lot of this stuff doesn't only not cost money, it saves money. Right? And the first time you need any of it and it's there, you'll be glad you did it. This is the big thing I have for you guys. And this is where I really think I should have moved this segment to the beginning. What you think can never happen has already happened. Everything that the person that lives the modern lifestyle says that can't happen in a place like this, it's already happened in a place just like you live in. The person that says no one would ever break into my house and kidnap my child in the middle of the night in this neighborhood, there's been a neighborhood that's probably better than yours where it happened. If we think back to, remember Elizabeth Smart? They lived in a beautiful neighborhood, in a beautiful community. There was a little girl, I don't remember her name, but was abducted on a street down in Lake Tahoe in a place where they barely even had a police department. They hadn't had a violent crime of any kind in 20 years. And somebody pulled that little girl off the street. I don't want you paranoid. I don't want parents like never letting their kids out of their sight again or anything. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just trying to put you in touch with reality. If that can happen, anything else that you think can't happen can happen. The economy of the United States could never collapse. It's a modern nation with a modern economy and a leader in the world in what it does. So was Argentina. Really? Argentina? Buenos Aires? Do you know what Buenos Aires was until 12 years ago when their economy melted to the ground? Buenos Aires was considered the Paris of South America. The Paris of South America. Oh, by the way, France is on the verge of economic collapse. Right? England's on the verge of economic collapse. This country's on the verge of economic collapse. But economic collapses of developed nations with monetary systems exactly like that which we have collapsed. So it can happen. It has happened. It can happen. War in a modern country amongst its own citizens can happen. Bosnia, okay? Bosnia is another place that we think of as this blown up, run down pile of rubble that's being rebuilt. But before the Balkan War, which is really the third Balkan War, it didn't look like that. It was an amazing place to live, a beautiful place. People wanted to go there and live there. It was a great cost of living. There was a lot of art. There was a lot of culture. And the next thing you know, neighbor's killing neighbor. Whatever you think can't happen, not only can happen, it's already happened. It may never happen to you. But if you think to yourself, that can never happen here, you're setting yourself up for failure. Because whatever you're saying that about, what you're really saying to yourself isn't, that can never happen here, right? And women, you're the worst. Women are the worst with this, especially the women that live in an upper-scale suburb, that grew up in the upscale suburb, that have always lived that way, that your grandfather had money, your daddy had money, and your husband has money. You're not the only ones, but those are the worst ones. Believe me, it can never happen. Yes, it can. Yes, it has. And sooner or later, again, for somebody else, yes, it will. And when they say, well, that can never happen here, what they're really saying, because they want to feel this way to make themselves feel good, nothing was like remotely like that will ever happen here. And even if the thing you're denying right now doesn't, something will. Something will go wrong in everybody's life sooner or later, and all but the luckiest individuals. And it only has to happen once. So you need to be prepared across the board with these six primary survival needs. I also want you to understand this. Preparing, food storage, adding security, everything we've talked about in the last 2 days is actually very easy to do and relatively inexpensive when times are good. If you want to see a microcosm of what happens the minute stress is put on a situation and what it does to the cost and availability of things, nothing could show you that more right now than the firearms industry. On November 15th, if you wanted to go buy an AR-15 and 10 30-round magazines, which, by the way, unless you live in New York or one of these other states that have their head up their fourth point of contact, is still completely legal and totally okay, and everybody can make them and everybody can ship them, and you wanted to buy that on November 15th of this last year, you could walk into just about any gun store in America and say, I'd like this, please, and they'd pull one off the shelf and give you a great price and a great deal, and they had it in stock. No problem. Go try to do that now. The gun that was selling for $900 is selling for $2,000, and the magazines are backordered for 3 or 4 months. Why? The fact that people are afraid the government will put restrictions on it. Just the fact that it might happen sucked up the supply overnight, drove up the price double, triple overnight, made certain things completely unavailable overnight. I want to ask you to do something for me, especially those of you that maybe the firearm subject is different for you. You're not maybe as emphatic about our rights with it as I am. I can accept that. That's your opinion. It's totally valid that you have that. And we won't even argue about it until you try to take away my rights, right? You can think that all you want as long as you let me do it. But let me even shelve that. I just want you to do this for me. I want you to pretend, just go into a little bit of a what-if scenario, that this same thing had happened with food. That there was a rumor that within 3 months there'd be major food shortages. What would your store shelves look like? And what would food cost if that rumor was circulated and generally accepted by 20% or 30% of the population even? As soon as the 20 or 30% started acting on it, they would make it a reality for the other 70 to 80% that didn't take it in. And it would cascade. And there'd be shortages everywhere. If what you think can't happen has already happened and will happen again. The gun industry is showing us what can happen to medical supplies, food, fresh water, generators, gasoline, diesel fuel, kerosene. It's showing us right now. You don't have to go, what does it look like? You can just go look at it right now and see what it looks like. It looks like scarcity and expensive. Right now, it's cheap and easy and plentiful. So it's easier to do now. That's why you should be doing it now. And the last thing I want to tell you is those of you that think I have plenty of time, I don't need to get started, I don't need to worry about this, this is all, yeah, he's making some sense, but nah, I don't know, and I got time for this, and I don't have time for that right now, and I'm whatever. Okay, preparing when times are bad is often impossible. You know, once whatever has happened happens, remember the what if? When I talk about somebody breaking in your home, you know, having their way with your female child in front of you while you're bound to a chair and thinking, what if I had put that can of pepper spray at the front door? What if I had locked the door? What if I had taken training? What if I did have a gun? What if my kids were told that this could happen and what to do if anything like it ever looked like it was? What if, right? How about what if I had just bought some more food when I could? What if I had just bought some more batteries for my flashlights when I could? Once the event triggers, if you've ever been through it, if you've ever been through a major hurricane or a major event, I can tell you that anybody that's been through it knows the pain of what if. And once you're getting to the what if, you know what that means? It ain't going to happen. It ain't possible. Right? And you think, well, next time will be different. And a lot of times you get a reset button. You get another attempt. You maybe do learn your lesson. You go from grasshopper to ant. But you know what happens to most grasshoppers in winter? They die. The ants chop them up in little pieces and take them down in their hole as their last protein store and eat them. And that's reality. I know that's not a real uplifting thing at the end, but I do have some uplifting thoughts for you here at the end, just to give you a little encouragement to do all of this stuff. It feels great. People ask me, well, what are you afraid of? And the reality is, not very much, because I've analyzed all this. Now, does that mean that I think that no matter what happens, I'll be 100% okay? But I know I've done what I could, and I will continue to try to do more. It's very empowering. You start to live your life incredibly different. I talk to people. I talk to people in just general day-to-day life. And I hear people say and do things, and I think, how can a person even think that way? And I realize it's because they're disempowered. You want to be an empowered person that lives life boldly? This is the pathway. Self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, and liberty in your own life. That's what preparedness is really all about. I hope you enjoyed this. I know I could have really made this into three episodes. Those of you that think this is a really long episode, hey man, listen and, you know, split it up or whatever, because I'm going to be out next week quite a bit with our moving, and then the following week even some. So I'll try to get what I can on air for you guys. But hopefully this is a great one for you to share. This might be one that I'll mix together into one big course and take all the commercial content out for sharing, but that'll have to happen next month with everything that's going on. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.